Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning. Happy Monday morning to you. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. Hope you're tanned, rested, and ready. I am. I think Cyrus is too. 888-914-9149. That's the number.
I don't tan. I just burn.
You look rested and ready, but yeah, you're right. I don't see a tan.
No. I burn, and then the burn goes away, and then I'm like translucent white again.
Are you one of those people who gets, judging from your pallor, you probably don't, you're not as bad as some people where they get a sunburn just from opening the refrigerator door.
No, I'm not that bad. But I do get that occasional like, ah, put a shirt on, like at the beach, you know. Like,
I want a hotkey of that sound.
It's too bright.
Yeah.
let me stare directly into the sun. It hurts less.
Oh, I know what you mean. But I have a tendency to brown very quickly. But in any case, regardless of our tanning abilities, welcome back. It's good to have everyone back. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We have lines open right now. And I thought I would begin. I don't normally begin with a letter, but I'd like to do so this morning. An interesting one. I don't think I've ever been asked this question before. And this is from an anonymous mom. And she wrote in to say, just before the pandemic lockdown of March of 2020, my son, who was then 15, was grappling with the typical teenage issues of sexual sin, and thankfully, he turned to God in prayer. He believes he underwent a conversion, and she has that in quotation marks, a conversion, and contends that God is calling him to become a monk. However, he seems to have gone too far too fast. Following his conversion, he prayed 4 to 5 hours a day, made a vow of chastity, and avidly read medieval monastic writers. Some of them emphasized despising the world and avoiding the corruption of society, which my husband and I feel is not consistent with Christ's actions or teaching. Aided by the pandemic lockdown, he withdrew socially and emotionally, shunning most of his friends because he viewed them as sinful. My son also decided he would forego college so that he could enter a monastery upon graduation from high school. We think a college degree and a marketable major would be helpful, regardless of which path he takes. Ultimately, after much discussion, and partly because his research had revealed most monasteries would not accept him at 18 years of age, my son promised he would get a college degree. We think it's very important that he mature and experience more of the world before discerning his ultimate vocation. We have told him that if he truly trusts in God, he would be open to whatever path God leads him to. However, he is very quick to dismiss the possibility that he could be anything but a monk. One more thing. My son may have romantic notions of monastic life, as a couple of years ago he read Thomas Merton's autobiography, The Seven-Story Mountain. So her concluding question here in her email says, is it okay for a high schooler to be fixated on achieving a consecrated life? Are we doing the right thing by urging him to postpone by 4 years what he feels now is a calling? Looking back at my own teenage years, I could barely choose a major in college, let alone a lifelong vocation. And that's from a concerned anonymous mom. Well, concerned anonymous mom, I completely understand your and your husband's concern about this. And I think you're on the right track, at least insofar as it seems. I think the way you put it's a good way to put it, too far too fast. And if the lad is not even 18 years of age yet, then he really is not in a position to know with certitude if this is the life that he's called to. It's possible, I suppose. And we're grateful and thankful for all those who are called to religious life. But he's not at an age yet where he can really know that for sure. And in fact, I would dare say that if he were to talk to a vocations director for one of the monasteries that he's looking into, I think the chances are pretty good that they would tell him the same thing. Even though they're probably hungry for vocations, they would probably, if they were wise, they would say, well, you need to wait a little bit. Maybe go get that college degree, because although early on, at least, he would not be in any type of permanent vows, that would take some years before he got to that point. it's still a commitment. And there's still an opportunity for him to think through before he were to take some final step. So even if he were miraculously to get into a monastery a year from now, the likelihood of an astute and experienced and wise vocations director just allowing this to happen, especially after talking to you and doing a psychological assessment, and I'm sure this issue that came up in his life the last couple of years would be bound to come up in a conversation like that. So I don't think on that score you have much to worry about. But here are a few thoughts. Keep in mind that figures such as St. Thomas Aquinas went through similar situations and actually persevered and went into religious life. In fact, St. Thomas Aquinas' story is very dramatic. He was born into a wealthy family, and they had grand designs for his future. He would be a prominent member of society, and he would do great things in academia or government or something, and they thought that he would continue with this family tradition of being very successful. He didn't want that. He wanted to join a relatively brand new order known as the Dominicans, and it is a mendicant order, especially back in those days, meaning that you didn't have like a food budget, you begged for food. And so his parents, who came from wealth and lived in a wealthy way, that's the last thing they wanted for their son. And even as a young man, he determined that he wanted to be a monk. That's what he wanted to do. That's all he wanted to do. And it got so bad, I mentioned dramatic, here's where the drama comes in. It got so bad, they actually like walled him into a room. They turned it into like a jail cell in their castle, in their home. And they wouldn't let him out. And he wouldn't relent. He just insisted he wanted to become a monk. And after, if I remember the story correctly, I believe it was something along the lines of like 2 years that he was cooped up in this place. And his brothers, they brought a woman of ill repute. By all accounts, she must have been quite attractive, young, nubile, etc. And they thought, well, you know, let's go nuclear on him, and let's shake loose any desire he has to be a monk by bringing this young woman into his jail cell and locking the door and leaving her alone with him. How stupid is that, right? So what does Thomas Aquinas do? He's defending his chastity. He's also defending his desire to be a priest. And so he grabbed a firebrand, you know, like a torch from the wall, the way they would light rooms in those days. And he brandished this torch. He had no intention, I don't think, of hurting the poor girl, but he brandished this torch and, you know, get out. Basically, he drove her out of his room. A lot of other men would have done something very different. But when they heard her crying out for help, they came and unlocked the door, let her out. And it's like, okay, I guess we're not going to be successful in preventing him from becoming religious. So they relented, and he wound up becoming one of the greatest Dominicans ever. Everybody knows his name, et cetera, et cetera. So I want to balance my comments by offering you that by way of consideration. It's not unheard of that God would grant a religious vocation to somebody, and that person perseveres, especially in the face of many difficulties like St. Thomas Aquinas did. But I'm guessing, anonymous mom, that this is probably not the case with your son. And the reason I'm guessing that is because he had, as you put it, a kind of crisis of faith because he had fallen into the sins of the flesh that are very common with teenagers and older people for that matter. And I think it, in a certain sense, if I had to guess, it probably a combination of embarrassment and I don't know, maybe just a really deep remorse for sin, it's prompting him to go in the other direction. And I suspect that in time, that will tend to dissipate. Not that we should, you know, not seek to be truly repentant of our sins. We should. If anything, more people have a problem with not really being very repentant of their sins. So in any event, it's a good thing if he has a really true, sincere repentance. But there are problems in the spiritual life, such as scrupulosity. Now, I don't know if he has that malady of the soul, but it could be something that maybe he's discovering without realizing what he's discovering, that he has this. And scrupulosity often takes the form of magnifying something that might be sinful, but magnifying it into something much more grave than it really is, or to see in something that is benign, not sinful, to see it as something gravely sinful. There are other manifestations, but those two are common. Now, I don't know if this is part of what he may be dealing with. A good experienced spiritual director, a good priest, I recommend a pre-spiritual director, could be very helpful in this regard. And maybe that might be the best advice I can give you for him would be to encourage him, okay, if you're thinking about religious life, fair enough, maybe God's calling you to that, maybe not. I think it's a great idea that you've agreed to get your college education, and it's not as though you want to stifle a potential priestly vocation by him going to college and getting distracted by girls, but there's a lot of wisdom in your and your husband's view that it would be good for him to know a little bit about the world before he retreats from the world and goes into religious life, if that's what God is calling him to do. And it may not be. It may be, may not be. Time will tell. So maybe the first bit of advice I can give you, and I'll leave it at that, would be to help him find a good, experienced spiritual director, preferably a priest. I'm not a fan of lay people who tout themselves as spiritual directors just because they got a certificate or they took a weekend course or something like that. Find a good, solid, experienced Catholic priest who can really help him discern these and other issues as things develop, especially if he's going to be in college, and naturally he's going to be seeing what that side of life is all about, and to have a good spiritual director will be helpful to him. I would start there. So I wouldn't clamp down. I wouldn't forbid him to do one thing or the other. Just gently encourage him, as you have been, and see how things develop. And my guess is that since he's not even 18 yet, by the time he's 20, 21, he may feel very, very committed to religious life, or he may look back on it and say, you know, that was a passing thing. And I realize now that God really didn't have that plan for me. So those are my thoughts, and I do appreciate you sending me that email. Let's go to the phones, 888-914-9149. We'll go to Queen Creek, Arizona, and talk to Harold. Good morning, Harold. You're first up today.
Good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Harold, this is the part where you and I have a conversation, so tell me what's on your mind, please.
Yes, I'm in a diaconal formation for, you know, 5 years, and I tried to raise my daughters Catholic, and my second oldest daughter is a second year of college. She's the one used to be thinking about becoming a nun.
Okay.
But now she's having some thoughts about being an atheist. So I was wondering if there's a way that, because of college and all that, she reads a lot of books, she's very smart. Mm-hmm. And I would like to see if you can have some recommendations about books that I can give to her so I can help her find the truth.
I certainly do. And I'm glad that you are looking out for her the way you are, Harold. Keep in mind that atheism is very fashionable nowadays, and increasingly so. And so, especially for younger people, they're running into it all over the place. And, you know, it's what the cool kids are doing. You know, they're atheists. And it's not cool if you are a theist, especially if you're a Christian theist like she used to be and probably still is deep down inside. So the first thing I'd recommend, the first thing I'd recommend, Harold, would be the author Edward Faeser, F-E-S-E-R. He's a philosopher, teaches at Pasadena City College in Southern California. I know him personally. He's very, very effective at refuting atheist claims. So he's written a number of books. If you look him up on Amazon, you'll find them there. His website, I believe, is edwardfaeser.com. And it looks like Fesser, but it's Faeser, like on Star Trek. Cyrus is smiling. So F-E-S-E-R. A couple of his books that come to mind would be The Last Superstition. Now, that's a critique of modern atheism. So if she's brainy and she likes to read, and it sounds like she is, then that book would probably appeal to her, because he in essence, he just sort of slices and dices all the major atheist claims about their belief in refuting the existence of God. Very, very effective. He has another book called The Five Proofs. Now, this is looking at five different philosophical or rational evidences for the existence of God. That, too, I think would be excellent for her. Then I would recommend Father Robert Spitzer's website. It's called Credible Catholic, and he deals a lot with atheist themes there. That's a good resource that's free, easy to get to, CredibleCatholic.com. And then also another resource also from Father Spitzer in this case is a book that he has on science and philosophy. I hope I have it. I want to see if I've got it, the title anyway, so I can give you the title. But Father Robert Spitzer is his name, S-P-I-T-Z-E-R. And I do believe I have it here. So yeah, it's called New Proofs for the Existence of God, Contributions of Contemporary Physics and Philosophy. And that book, which is in my library and I like it, I think would be another book that would appeal to her, Harold. So there you go. Your arms are loaded down with some good recommendations to get her started.
Thank you, Patrick. God bless you. If you can please pray for her, my family, I'll keep on praying for you.
I will indeed. And thank you, Harold. I appreciate that. Oh, you know, before you go, one other thing comes to mind. And that is, I'll take one step back and just say that I teach, and I have taught now for about 10 years, every semester, summer, fall, spring semester, I teach undergraduate and graduate students apologetics. And I teach on the faculty of Holy Apostles College and Seminary in Cromwell, Connecticut. And I teach in the online department. I don't commute to Cromwell, Connecticut. I also teach the seminarians at St. Patrick's Seminary and University in Menlo Park, California. So I'm helping to try to form priests in this area, but also to form lay people. And I make them watch, because the first quarter of the course involves dealing with atheism and all of its various arguments. And so one of the requirements that they go through is to watch a video on YouTube, which you can easily get, between William Lane Craig and Christopher Hitchens, who is now no longer, I'm quite certain, an atheist. He died some years ago, and now he knows. But in any case, he was one of the leading atheist voices that came out of sort of like the early 21st century cavalcade of atheists, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, and others. He was one of like the really big guys. And so this debate took place at Biola University in Southern California, spelled B-I-O-L-A. And it's a debate on the existence of God. So William Lane Craig is making the case for the existence of God. Christopher Hitchens is trying to make his case that God doesn't exist. And it's one of those really good debates that I make my students watch. And they're really glad that they watch it, because they come away from it thinking, wow, I always thought that atheism was so formidable. And I always thought that atheism had such great arguments. And you'll see on display there that not only is the atheist argument not strong, but the theist argument, as espoused by William Lane Craig, is very cogent. It's very logical. It's very airtight. And it's consistent and coherent, whereas I would argue that Christopher Hitchens' presentation is not. It's very erudite. He has a British accent that you can listen to all day long. But in the end, he doesn't really make his case at all. And that's just one of a number of really good debates with atheists on this topic, does God exist? And that's free. And that's available on the YouTubes. So if you have a chance, just go there, type in Biola debate, does God exist? And then maybe watch that with your daughter, because I have a feeling you too will actually pick up some good tools and things from that. Hey, Harold, thank you. I appreciate the phone call. And I will pray for your daughter and you and your preparation for talking to her further about the belief in God. I'll be right back.
Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
You probably have heard by now, because the news just broke a few days ago, that Archbishop Cordiglione of San Francisco, that he publicly admonished Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, to refrain from receiving Holy Communion because of her radical pro-abortion views. Now, as you might imagine, he's getting a lot of pushback and a lot of opprobrium from a lot of the usual suspects, including, by the way, in the Catholic Church. Somebody noted on Twitter, and I think it's a very astute observation. Mr. Casey on Twitter, I retweeted it if you want to see it. He says, notice that many who insisted that we follow the CDF's document on the COVID vaccines are the very same ones who now strenuously object to Archbishop Cordiglione following the CDF's document on worthy reception of Holy Communion. CDF stands for Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And there is an attached link to an article on basically that gives these general principles. This is from the former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger. I'll read that first, and then I will share with you what Archbishop Cordiglione had himself had to say in his letter to Nancy Pelosi. So this is dated 2004, and it was a year before, not quite a year before, Cardinal Ratzinger was elected Pope Benedict XVI. So when this was promulgated under the pontificate of Pope John Paul II, here's what it says, and this document stands to this day. Presenting oneself to receive Holy Communion should be a conscious decision based on a reasoned judgment regarding one's worthiness to do so, according to the Church's objective criteria, asking such questions as, am I in full communion with the Catholic Church? Am I guilty of grave sin? Have I incurred a penalty, such as excommunication or interdict, that forbids me to receive Holy Communion? Have I prepared myself by fasting for at least an hour? The practice, he says, of indiscriminately presenting oneself to receive Holy Communion merely as a consequence of being present at Mass is an abuse that must be corrected. And here there's a footnote citing Redemptionis Sacramentum, which is Latin for the Sacrament of Redemption, if you want to read some of the underlying magisterial documents that support what he's saying here. He says the Church teaches that abortion or euthanasia is a grave sin. The encyclical letter Evangelium Vitae, that was from Pope John Paul II, with reference to judicial decisions or civil laws that authorize or promote abortion or euthanasia, states that there is, quote, a grave and clear obligation to oppose them by conscientious objection in the case of an intrinsically unjust law, such as a law permitting abortion or euthanasia. It is therefore never licit to obey it, being the law, or to take part in a propaganda campaign in favor of such a law or vote for it. Christians have a grave obligation of conscience not to cooperate formally in practices which, even if permitted by civil legislation, are contrary to God's law. Indeed, from the moral standpoint, it is never licit to cooperate formally in evil. This cooperation can never be justified either by invoking respect for the freedom of others or by appealing to the fact that civil law permits it or requests it. Not all moral issues have the same moral weight as abortion and euthanasia. For example, if a Catholic were to be at odds with the Holy Father on the application of capital punishment, or on the decision to wage war, he would not for that reason be considered unworthy to present himself to receive Holy Communion. While the Church exhorts civil authorities to seek peace, not war, and to exercise discretion and mercy in imposing punishments on criminals, it may still be permissible to take up arms to repel an aggressor or to have recourse to capital punishment. There may be a legitimate diversity of opinion, even among Catholics, about waging war and applying the death penalty, but not, however, with regard to abortion and euthanasia. Apart from an individual's judgment about his worthiness to present himself to receive the Holy Eucharist, the minister of Holy Communion may find himself in the situation where he must refuse to distribute Holy Communion to someone, such as in the cases of a declared excommunication, a declared interdict. An interdict, by the way, is it's a canonical term that refers to when some person or group of persons is forbidden from receiving the sacraments, or an obstinate persistence in manifest grave sin. And there it cites Canon 915. regarding the grave sin of abortion or euthanasia when a person's formal cooperation becomes manifest, understood in the case of a Catholic politician as his consistently campaigning and voting for permissive abortion and euthanasia laws. When this happens, his pastor should meet with him, instructing him about the church's teaching, informing him that he is not to present himself for Holy Communion until he brings to an end the objective situation of sin, and warning him that he will otherwise be denied the Eucharist. When these precautionary measures have not had their effect, or in which they were not possible, and the person in question, with obstinate persistence, still presents himself to receive the Holy Eucharist, the minister of Holy Communion must refuse to distribute it. This decision, properly speaking, is not a sanction or a penalty, nor is the minister of Holy Communion passing judgment on the person's subjective guilt, but rather is reacting to the person's public unworthiness to receive Holy Communion due to an objective situation of sin. So that's the underlying document from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And so now I will read to you the text of Archbishop Corleone's letter to Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, in which he bans her from receiving Holy Communion. To the Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States Congress, Nancy Pelosi. The Second Vatican Council, in its decree on the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, reiterated the Church's ancient and consistent teaching that from the first moment of conception, life must be guarded with the greatest care, while abortion and infanticide are unspeakable crimes. Christians have indeed always upheld the dignity of human life in every stage, especially the most vulnerable, beginning with life in the womb. His Holiness Pope Francis, in keeping with his predecessors, has likewise been quite clear and emphatic in teaching on the dignity of human life in the womb. This fundamental moral truth has consequences for Catholics in how they live their lives, especially those entrusted with promoting and protecting the public good of society. Pope St. John Paul II was also quite consistent in upholding this constant teaching of the Church, and frequently reminded us that, though, and this is a quote from John Paul II, those who are directly involved in lawmaking bodies have a grave and clear obligation to oppose any law that attacks human life. For them, as for every Catholic, it is impossible to promote such laws or to vote for them. A Catholic legislator, Archbishop Corleone continues, who supports procured abortion after knowing the teaching of the Church commits a manifestly grave sin, which is a cause of most serious scandal to others. Therefore, universal church law provides that such persons, quote, are not to be admitted to Holy Communion. This is the Code of Canon Law, Canon 915. With regard to the application of these principles to Catholics in political life, then Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, as prefect of the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, wrote to the U.S. bishops in 2004 explaining the approach taken. And I just quoted to you that document, so I won't re-quote this to you, but it's the part where it says that if a Catholic politician's formal cooperation in the sin of abortion is manifest, in other words, people know it, it's public, it's persistent, then that person is not permitted to receive Holy Communion. So the Archbishop continues, "In striving to follow this direction, I am grateful to you for the time you have given me in the past to speak about these matters. Unfortunately, I have not received such an accommodation to my many requests to speak with you again since you vowed to codify the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision in federal law following upon the passage of Texas Senate Bill 8 last September. That is why I communicated my concerns to you via letter on April the 7th, 2022, and informed you there that, should you not publicly repudiate your advocacy for abortion, quote-unquote, rights, or else refrain from referring to your Catholic faith in public and receiving Holy Communion, I would have no choice but to make a declaration, in keeping with Canon 915, that you are not to be admitted to Holy Communion. As you have not publicly repudiated your position on abortion, and continue to refer to your Catholic faith in justifying your position and to receive Holy Communion, that time has now come. Therefore, in light of my responsibility as the Archbishop of San Francisco to be concerned for all the Christian faithful entrusted to my care, by means of this communication, I am hereby notifying you that you are not to present yourself for Holy Communion, and should you do so, you are not to be admitted to Holy Communion until such time as you publicly repudiate your advocacy for the legitimacy of abortion and confess and receive absolution of this grave sin in the sacrament of penance. Please know that I stand ready to continue our conversation at any time and will continue to offer up prayer and fasting for you. I also ask all the faithful of the Archdiocese of San Francisco to pray for all of our legislators, especially Catholic legislators, who promote procured abortion, that with the help and under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, they may undergo a conversion of heart in this most grave matter, and human life may be protected and fostered in every stage and condition of life. And this is given at San Francisco on the 19th day of May in the year of our Lord, 2022, signed Salvatore J. Corleone, Archbishop of San Francisco. And you can read this letter when you go to the show Twitter feed, at P. Madrid Show. You'll find not only the letter, but some accompanying documents, such as the one that I just read to you from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So there's the letter. Now, as I understand it, Archbishop Corleone spoke to our audience a little bit earlier today, and I think we're going to have some audio later in the show today, in which you'll be able to hear him, you know, the Archbishop himself, discussing this in a little more depth. You may ask yourself, well, isn't this politicizing the Eucharist? No. It's so tiresome to hear people say that this is politicizing the Eucharist. This is not politicizing the Eucharist. It's not weaponizing the Eucharist or any of those other things. The Archbishop is doing what the Church asks bishops to do. And that's stated in magisterial documents like the one I just quoted from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And you'll notice there that they make a very specific distinction because, you know, the Amen corner, they start up immediately with the whole idea about, well, how come when, William Barr, I forget what his first name is, the Attorney General under Trump. His last name was Barr, B-A-R-R, a Catholic. And so the Amen corner starts up with, well, how come I didn't see bishops saying that he had, he shouldn't be receiving communion, or wherever the bishops, so how come they weren't telling him not to receive communion because he was in favor of capital punishment? That document, which predates the revision to the catechism that Pope Francis made, granted, but it nonetheless states the essence of the Church's teaching on the fact that the death penalty, capital punishment, is not intrinsically evil. So it's drawing a distinction there between the intrinsic evil of abortion and euthanasia with the death penalty. And I'll leave it to others to wrangle over that issue. But the fact is that this bishop is doing what bishops are said and are called to do by the Church, by Christ, to protect the flock, to admonish the sinner, all the things that we are called to do. Now, don't be taken in by this claptrap about the bishop is politicizing the Eucharist. It's exactly the opposite. These Catholic politicians have politicized a moral issue. And that moral issue has to do with the dignity of unborn human life, dignity of all life, indeed, but in particular, unborn, defenseless human life. And so you can thank the politicians for politicizing a moral issue that wasn't political. It wasn't at all political, let's say from the 1960s and before that. It was not a political issue. If you were to consider the party planks in the party for the Democratic Party position on social issues, you would not have seen anything about abortion because it wasn't an issue in those days. But it became an issue not because the Church politicized it, certainly not because a bishop standing up for what the Church has always taught on this issue, quote unquote, politicized it. That's not true. The politicians, they politicized a moral issue. So again, don't be taken in by that line of thought. This has nothing to do with, quote unquote, weaponizing the Eucharist or any of that other stuff. And for that matter, very interesting article here in CatholicEducation.org about how bishops have done this before. And in among other situations involving racism. And I'll get into that in just a little bit. We're going to take a break in a moment and we'll come back and talk more about that. I do welcome your phone calls, 888-914-9149. Let's take a couple of quick calls before we go to the break. Let's go to Hunter in Merrill, Wisconsin. Good morning, Hunter.
Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is kind of about marriage and family. I'm currently engaged. My fiance and I are both students in college and say pretty devout Catholics. Mm-hmm. But we're getting married in January, and so we'll still have a semester of school left. And yeah, we're both very open to life and definitely want to have children as soon as the Lord wills it. But my question is, how, like, tips for how to decide when that's a prudent thing to do, especially like financially, since we both won't have much money come out of college. Just, yeah, how to decide when the best time is to have kids, or like when it's a good time to know when to wait or prolong having children.
Okay. I don't mean to sound glib, and this is not intended to sound glib, but the best time to start is your wedding night. Obviously not before that, but the best time to start is your wedding night. And just put your marriage into the hands of the Lord. Lord, you have a plan for us. We're not entirely sure what that plan is, but we're open to your plan. We're open to life. We're open to you showing us how you want to bless us. And I would absolutely advise you not to make use of NFP early on. There's no reason to. There's no reason to. Let your marriage be fruitful. And if it's fruitful from the very beginning, great. If it's not, that's part of God's plan too. But I would begin on your wedding night. And what I mean by that is just don't do anything that would inhibit or foreclose upon the possibility of God blessing your marriage with life. It may happen sooner or later, but likely it will happen. More likely than not, it will happen sooner. Now, you mentioned about being in school. Well, if I'm just doing a little bit of mental calculation here, if your wedding is in January and you only have one semester left after that, even if your wife got pregnant on your wedding night, she's not going to deliver a baby until after she graduates. So you don't really have a, you know, there's no real conflict like, you know, well, we will just have had a baby when graduation happens, because the delivery wouldn't be for a few months after that in any case. So that would be my heartfelt advice. Just, you know, start your marriage prepared for whatever God may send you by way of blessings with children. And then when you have been married for a while and you are wisely and prudently looking at things like your finances and your health, what the social circumstances are, those things begin to come into play eventually. And you may have to use NFP for spacing conception for a time possibly, but maybe not. You may not have to do that at all. But I wouldn't start on that foot. I would start with a regular, here we go, and let's see what happens. That's what I would recommend.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that's exciting to hear. So thanks for your advice.
You're most welcome, and may the Lord give you both many happy years together. And if it's his will, many happy, healthy children as well, Hunter. Thank you. I'm going to take a break, and then we'll come back, take a few more phone calls, but I also want to share with you some examples of other bishops who have denied politicians communion. And you may say, well, tell me more. I will, right after this. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Let's get back to the phones. My number is 888-914-9149. I thank you for listening. 888-914-9149. How about Mark in Maple Lake, Minnesota? Good morning, Mark.
Hey, good morning, Patrick. You know, I don't know if I missed something or not, but one of the major opponents of abortion is the President of the United States, who espouses to be Catholic. I mean, why has he been called out, or why has he not been called out by the magistrate?
Well, I don't know the answer to those questions. I can tell you that it's not the magisterium that does this, it's the local bishop. So take the case of Nancy Pelosi, who resides in the Archdiocese of San Francisco. So Archbishop Corleone is her bishop. And so he would be an example of a bishop who is, you know, he's doing what the church says the bishop should do under these circumstances. So the diocese in which Joe Biden resides is Wilmington, Delaware. And so that may be the place where the bishop of that diocese has had conversations with him. I don't know. This is what I mean by I don't know. I don't know what private conversations may or may not have been had. And then your question, why not do so publicly? That's another question that I don't have an answer for. This is ultimately up to the bishop of the diocese. And so That's about all I can tell you, because I don't know. You can pray for all bishops that they would do the right thing under these difficult circumstances. One thing I'm happy to report to you, Mark, is that many bishops around the country, not as many as I would have expected, but many of them have publicly come out in support and encouragement of Archbishop Cordiglione. I've got a few here on my Twitter feed. So Archbishop Paul Coakley of Oklahoma City, he says, "I applaud the courage of Archbishop Cordiglione and his leadership in taking this difficult step. Let us continue to pray for Archbishop Cordiglione, priest of the Archdiocese of San Francisco, Speaker Pelosi, for the protection of the unborn and for the conversion of hearts and minds." Bishop Papraki of Springfield, he says, "I fully support and earnestly commend Archbishop Cordiglione's action in regard to Speaker Pelosi. All politicians who promote abortion should not receive Holy Communion until they have repented, repaired scandal, and been reconciled to Christ and the Church." Archbishop Samuel Aquila of Denver, he says, "I support and commend my brother Bishop, Archbishop Cordiglione, for making this courageous, compassionate, and necessary decision." And he has a full statement of support that he published in the Archdiocesan newspaper, and you can read that because he has a link to it if you're interested, Mark. Bishop James Connolly, the Bishop of Lincoln, Nebraska, he says, "I support Archbishop Cordiglione in his courageous pastoral outreach to a member of his flock. His actions are made as a shepherd with the heart of Christ." Bishop Michael Barber of Oakland, he says, "I support Archbishop Cordiglione in the heroic and compassionate stance he took today in protecting the defense of human life." As Pontifex, that's Pope Francis, said, quote, "Every child who, rather than being born, is condemned unjustly to being aborted, bears the face of Jesus Christ." And there are other accolades from other bishops who publicly praise Archbishop Cordiglione for doing what he's done. I would like to see more bishops do this. I think it would be very helpful all the way around. But that much I can tell you, Mark. There is some of that public encouragement and support for this. I hope that gives you some encouragement yourself. Let's go to Marilyn now in Franklin Park, New Jersey. Hello, Marilyn.
Hi. Hi, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just so supporting this bishop and the relevant radio has been talking about it. I'm a convert. I'm an older woman. But I have had relatives in the Catholic Church, friends. I had an employer, and there is nothing that turns off a Protestant than Catholics that don't work their Catholic faith. They believe in abortion. They don't go to church, and someone will say something about the Catholic Church, and they'll say, "Oh, I'm the Catholic Church, but I don't believe X, Y, and Z." And it's like, well, why in the Catholic Church? I've been trying to pray for her and other politicians, but I'm beginning to think I'd rather be praying to their guardian angels because they need strength to do what they need to do. And how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, having a devotion to the Holy Angels is a good thing, if you ask me. So, yeah, if you invoke their intercession for the people they're assisting, that can only be a good thing. Pray to God for their conversion of heart. Pray the rosary, a powerful weapon against heresy, among other things. And being pro-abortion is a kind of heresy, in a way, because the Church has formally declared many times over that abortion is intrinsically evil. And so to publicly deny that, to my mind, rises to the level, in a certain sense at least, it sort of rises to the level of being a formal heretic. Because although it's not a formally defined dogma of the faith, I would say it is a dogma in the sense that it has been declared repeatedly by popes. It's like Pope Paul VI, for example, in 1968 with Humanae Vitae, or Pope Pius XI in 1920-21 when he issued Casti Connubii. The statements of Pope John Paul II with Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life. And those are just in the 20th century. So that taken together with the direct revelation in the Bible, thou shalt not kill. I mean, it seems to me to be so clearly officially taught by the church that somebody with a straight face can't really deny it. And so in a sense, it seems to me to sort of rise to the level of being formally a heretic. And if you formally deny a de fide teaching of the church, well, the church is required to, as Jesus himself says in Matthew chapter 18, if you won't listen even to the church, Jesus says, then treat him as a Gentile or a tax collector. That's a euphemism, given the circumstances in those days. It's a euphemism for excommunication, where you are basically cut off from the life of the sacraments, and it's not as a punishment. Rather, it's like a wake-up call, so that you would recognize the extreme spiritual danger you put yourself in and make your way back to safety. So the church doesn't make use of excommunications as a way to punish somebody or beat that person with a stick. Rather, to say, wake up before it's too late. Wake up. You're in really grave danger right now. Come back. So I look at this issue along those lines. And we'll see. Maybe this is the beginning of a tipping point with what Archbishop Corleone had to say on this issue. Thanks for the call, Marilyn. I appreciate it. Let's go to Corky in Atlanta. Good morning, Corky.
Good morning. I just want to, I'm in Michigan, of course, and I did not see any bishop from Michigan giving their support to the Archbishop Corleone. And so I'm writing my bishop to ask him to please support the action, and I'm encouraging others to also write their bishops because, you know, I already read that the San Francisco editorial is asking for the Archbishop's, whatever, barometer or loss of his Archbishop's, whatever it is. But
that's so silly.
He's going to be facing a lot of this, and we need to show support for this action because they will come at him terribly.
Oh, they have been, Corky. Believe me, they have been. But I'm happy to tell you, this should give you some hope and encouragement. Many bishops around the country have done this, and I suspect many more have done it privately. So it may well be that he has received gestures and comments of support that haven't been made public. So let's not underestimate that. I know there's a great rapport among many bishops in this country, thankfully, and they're very, very serious about the collegiality aspect of their ministry as bishops. So, yes, I share your view. It would be wonderful if more and more bishops were to make their support public. But, you know, in some cases, it may not have been made public, but it's still there, and we can assume the best on those parts. So thanks for that. I appreciate the phone call. I want to share with you just a few details here about bishops who have done this before. So, for example, in the wake of the United States Supreme Court's 1954 Brown versus Board of Education ruling, and this is an article at CatholicEducation.org, we'll get a link to it for you, Joseph Francis Rummel, the Archbishop of New Orleans, began planning the integration of the Archdiocese's schools. They would take 8 years, several court battles, and the excommunication of three prominent Catholic political figures in order for the Archbishop to achieve his goal of desegregating the schools. As Americans debate the public and private responsibilities of Catholic politicians in this election year, the story of Archbishop Rummel's decision to use the serious punishment of excommunication with members of his flock is returning to the national conscience. This time, the story is being wielded in a way that would deal with communion and abortion. But it's interesting to note that Archbishop Rummel, he was concerned about racial integration even before Brown versus Board of Education was handed down in 1953, a year before that decision. He wrote a pastoral letter called Blessed Are the Peacemakers that ended segregation in archdiocesan parishes. In another pastoral letter in 1956, he wrote that compulsory racial segregation is morally wrong and sinful. So if you read through the story here, what you see is by no means is what Archbishop Corleone doing the first time a bishop has done this on a moral and political issue. So the morality of, or the immorality as the case may be, of slavery was politicized, certainly, and it remained politicized from that point forward. And the Archbishop recognizing that he had a duty to step forward and to denounce racism and white supremacy in the community that he had charge over, that it was wrong and sinful. And he appropriately used this tool that is granted to the church to use, this is Canon 915, to excommunicate Catholic politicians who went along with and even supported racial segregation. And Canon 915 reads, requires that those who obstinately persevere in manifest grave sin are not to be admitted to Holy Communion. So this is not something new. It's something different, at least in recent years, that's for sure. But I hope that it actually becomes more and more common, not because we want to go out and, you know, beat on people. That's the last thing we want to do. And if you read Archbishop Corleone's letter, you realize that he's seeking after one of the lost sheep. And that is what bishops are supposed to do, supposed to go out in search of them and find them, and if possible, bring them home. And that's what he's trying to do. So this is for Nancy Pelosi's spiritual welfare. I mean, if you don't like her, you don't like her politics. I personally find her politics revolting. But I do care about her eternal soul, and I would seek after her happiness in this life and in the life to come. And if I saw that there was something that would stand in the way of her being together with God forever in heaven, and there was something that I, if I were a bishop, could do about it, I would do it. Otherwise, I would be derelict in my duty. So once again, this is not weaponizing the Eucharist. This is not politicizing the Eucharist or any of those things that some people are trying to spin this into. It's not that at all. It's a good bishop doing a good job trying to protect his flock and go in search of a lost sheep. I'm coming back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this.